In order, please.
I'm on the go home. I'll see you guys tomorrow. Oh, I have one thing, then I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah. Okay. Messages from the House.
February the 12th, 2013, from the House of Representatives. Message number 316, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate Joint Resolution 1, qualification for University of Wyoming trustee. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 42, noes 15, excused 3. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 12th, 2013, from the House of Representatives, message number 8, Mr. President. The House has completed consideration of the budget bill, Senate File 1, pursuant to Joint Rule 14-1. Senate File 1 is referred directly to a conference committee of 5 members from each House to meet and report recommended amendments for final consideration by both Houses with respect to budget bills, Senate File 1 and House Bill 1, and amendments thereto. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. You want back? Okay. February the 12th, 2013. From the House of Representatives, message number 318, conferees appointed Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to House Bill 1. The House conferees are Representative Harshman, Chairman, Representative Esquibel, Ken Esquibel, Representative Bob Nicholas, Representative Stubson, and Representative Wallace. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 12th, 2013, from the House of Representatives, message number 317. Conferees appointed Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to Senate File 76. The House conferees are Representative Moniz, Chairman, Representative Goggles, and Representative Somers. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
February the 12th, 2013, Mr. President. Your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 215, engrossed state investments for a public purpose, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senator Anderson, 28, Senators Case, Emmerich, Peterson, Von Platern, Senator Peterson, Chairman. February the 12th, 2013, Mr. Premier, Committee Number 7, Corporation Electoral Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 42, Land Use Planning, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Nutting, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 12th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 98, County Fees, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, and Nutting, excuse Senator Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 12th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 7, Corporation Election and Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 26, Appraisal Management Company Regulation. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Nutty, and Scott. Senator Case, Chairman. February the 12th, 2013, Mr. President, Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, to whom was referred House Bill 85 in gross, Municipal Jurisdiction Extraterritorial Authority. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, and Scott. No, Senator Nutting. Senator Case, Chairman. February the 11th, 2013, Mr. President, Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highway, Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 161, engrossed, Outdoor Advertising Fees. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Escobel, Landon, Von Fladern. No, Senators Cooper and Schiffer. Senator Von Fladern, Chairman.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. House Bill 26, Appraisal Management Company Regulation. It was just read in. It does contain an appropriation, and I'd ask that it be referred to the Appropriations Committee.
Thank you, Senator Case. Without objection, House Bill 26 will be re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. Bills on third reading and final passage. Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, just announcement, the Conference Committee on Senate File 76, Bighorn Sheep Relocation, will meet Wednesday, February 13th at 7:40 in the morning, tomorrow, in room S-15, Senate Ag.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. House bills on third reading. House Bill 11, third reading of the House bill.
House Bill 11, Insurance Holding Company System Regulatory Act, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, an act relating to insurance holding companies, be it enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
House Bill 11, having been read three separate times, the question is, shall the bill pass? Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Dockstader.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Emmerich.
Aye.
Esquibel.
Aye.
Geis.
Aye.
Hastert.
Aye.
Hicks.
Aye.
Hines.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Landon.
Meyer, aye.
Nicholas,
aye.
Nutting,
aye.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Von Fletern,
aye.
President Ross,
aye.
Closing vote closed, 30 ayes.
House Bill 11. Having received the affirmative vote of the majority members elected to the Senate, House Bill 11 has passed the Senate. House Bill 221, third reading of the House bill.
House Bill 221, State Government Fraud Reduction Act Reporting Requirements, sponsored by Representative Lubnow, an act relating to administration of government, be it enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
House Bill 221, having been read three separate times, the question is, shall the bill pass? Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson, District 2.
Aye.
Anderson, District 28.
Aye.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Kraft.
Aye.
Dockstader.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Emmerich. Esquibel, Geis,
aye.
Hastert,
aye.
Hicks,
aye.
Hines,
aye.
Johnson,
aye.
Landon,
aye.
Meyer,
aye.
Nicholas,
aye.
Nutting,
aye.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Rothfuss,
aye.
Schiffer.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Von Flatern.
Aye.
President Ross.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote close. 30 ayes.
House Bill 221, having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, House Bill 221 has passed the Senate. House Bill 250, third reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 250, Public Employee Retirement Plan, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee, an act relating to public employees. Be it enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
We have some amendments. Third reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 250. Would the reading clerk please read it in?
House Bill 250, third reading amendment number 1. Delete the Bebout second reading amendment.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move third reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 250 and ask for your favorable consideration. Members of the Senate, this is just simply, we had the debate yesterday on the amendment on second reading. I just want to just add a couple points and just ask for your consideration. I know that we all value our state employees, and in the bill, the way it was originally structured is how JAC decided to use the salary compensation, and this is a way to help the retirement system. It was a tax savings for both employees and employers, and it was the decision that kind of with the limited funds, it was a way to get more bang for the buck. And I don't want to belabor this, Mr. President, but I just ask for your favorable consideration.
Discussion, Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. President, on and against the amendment. And we did have some good discussion yesterday about this very thing. And the overriding factor, members of the Senate, is the reason we have this bill in the first place is because we had some concerns about the actuarial soundness of the big plan and the other plans included in this bill. And I think we're not upholding our fiduciary responsibility if we don't do all we can to ensure their plan and their retirement plan, and it is theirs, it's not ours, that it remains actuarially sound. And so that's the overriding factor. And what we did is it's just a matter of fairness, and we've asked the state employees and the different people to participate 50-50 in it. I will tell you, under the current plan, right now the employee pays 1.43% and the state pays 12.69%. Now, that's a 10-to-1 ratio of how much more the state pays than the employee, and I'm okay with that. I mean, there are reasons we did it, and we have some wonderful state employees. That's our commitment to them. I will tell you that if you look around the country and all of the retirement plans that have good actuarial studies, most of them have that ratio instead of being 10-to-1, the state or the employer paying for the employee are 50-50. And so all we're doing here by defeating this amendment, and keeping the one we put on yesterday as being fair as we move forward, that we share the cost.
Further discussion. Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, on and for the amendment. Senate, we have to show some loyalty to our public employees and to the people that work for the state. And we've been refusing to give them external cost adjustments for a lot of years, asking them to, cinch up, to understand that we've got revenue shortfalls, that we've got a difficult future ahead, that we can't afford to give cost of living adjustments, that the reason that their salaries purchasing power has eroded by perhaps 10% for the last 5 years is because we just don't have the revenue to support them. But we all know how much revenue we have at this point. We recognize that we're putting it into savings, and we recognize that we're doing that as an investment in the future. But one of the reasons that we're giving and that we gave that we couldn't afford an ECA this year was because we were going to give the match of the percentage point, a little over a percentage point, on the retirement, which was this original piece of legislation. So there was something. There was something that we could say to the public employees that we're providing you with that future support. We're giving you not just the match, as we amended it to, but we're giving you the full amount, we're picking that up, and that is in lieu of that cost of living adjustment. So it was fair. It was difficult. It was difficult because we still weren't giving any more take-home pay to our public employees. But it was fair because we recognize that we have to make sure that this remains actuarially sound into the future. We recognize that there are tax benefits to picking up the full amount instead of giving them the cash that they would like in terms of a take-home pay. But unless we pass this amendment and undo what we did yesterday, we've taken that away too. And the question then becomes, how much can we ask of our public employees? How much cutting of their purchasing power are they going to sustain before they start looking somewhere else? I know at my university, people are already looking somewhere else. You can only stop giving them pay increases. Well, they're not pay increases. They're cost of living adjustments. I should say, you can only erode their pay for so long before they're waiting for someone else to come along and call. And it's not going to be, you know, the employees that we want to keep around that are going to stay around. Because those are the ones that are in demand everywhere. Our best are the ones that can be easily cherry-picked by other states and by other companies. Those are the ones that are going to be the first to go. So the longer we go down the path where we don't provide simple cost of living adjustments, which again is not a pay increase, it's just making sure they could buy as much this year as they could next year and the following year. The longer we go without those, and the longer we do things like this, where we erode their salary further to keep their retirement actuarially sound, the more likely we are to lose the best we have. So, I would encourage the body to adopt this amendment to recognize that we can certainly afford it. We're not even close to having a problem with affording it. To recognize that we need to do something, to be able to take something back to our people and say, look, we did this for you. It might not be as much as you want, but we did this for you. Mr. President, I'd ask the body to support this amendment.
Further discussion. Senator Barnard.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand this, we as a state made a commitment to these people, and I think that when we do that with our state employees, we ought to try to do our very best to try to keep that commitment. Now, if that's wrong, please correct me. But when we say something and we give our word on this, I think we should keep it. So I would hope that you'll support this amendment.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. President, on and for the amendment. But really, I rise to just pose the same question that my colleague from Albany County did, which is, you know, what understanding did all of you have when we came down to this session? Because my understanding was, and what I told a lot of people who asked, I said, you know, we're going to battle down there with decreasing revenues and forecasts that don't look very good. And so, you know what? It's going to be tough. But I think what our leadership has indicated to us is that we're going to try to pick up that insurance or the retirement pay. That's something that we think we can do for our public employees. And that's what I told folks back home. Well, I'm getting emails today saying, you know, what is going on here? Are you guys going to come out of there with anything? And I'm not going to go back over all the good points that my friend from Laramie made, but, you know, at some point, you know, I guess I'd like a bigger picture of where are we going for our public employees. For some of those up in my district, it's been 3 years since we've even had a cost of living increase for those people. Retirement pay, yeah, we try to make the distinction that it's theirs and it's not ours. But that's how we hold those public employees. That's this retirement fund, that's how we can pay them a little bit less than they make in the private sector. You know, I think this is the right thing to do. I think it's what we told them we were going to do on and for the amendment.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. You know, we all value our state employees, and we went through a long stretch of being able to give them significant raises We've taken their salaries. I think when I started in, we were, say, 70% of market. We got up to 90% of market. We've dropped a couple notches. I think we ought to make an effort to get those back. And this year was a tight year. We're looking at reducing budgets, and everybody has to share in it. State employees are no different. And many of you have children out there that are working in the private world. They're not getting raises this year. A lot of them aren't. They haven't had raises for several years. There are kids, families out there that frankly can't even find jobs. And in an environment that we find ourselves, having a job that provides great health care, having a job that provides a retirement, and 90% of market is a pretty good deal. But let's talk then about the retirement issue. Retirement accounts are, in essence, a joint agreement where we've historically said, you pay half, we'll pay half. And when employees are paying half, they tend to, they put people on the retirement committee or the oversight committee. They marshal the assets well. They tend to the cost of living. And what we found ourselves at one time is where we agreed to pay the employee share. And then shortly after that, we saw an effort by the retirement board to say, well, this is great. Now let's increase the cost of living multipliers. Let's increase cost of living. Let's increase the multipliers by which we calculate these amounts. And I go back to think at that time, it just was sort of a give me. Everybody was entitled to it. Nobody paid into it. Nobody watched it, except for the taxpayer who was asked to fill the gap when the monies weren't there and when the management style rendered a system that was inequitable. And for those reasons, as much as I do want to help state employees, but it's a bad practice to put in a system where all the retirement is paid for by one. Now, it's been pointed out that under all circumstances, under all of these amendments, the state is going to pay one half. How many of your children, how many of you have your employer paying one half of your retirement benefits every year? But we're going to pay one half, and the only question is whether the state employee pays the other half. And we still have a system where we're paying five percentage points of the employee's share, because that practice was in place. But as we find ourselves digging out of a hole, and more has to be paid into contributions for state employees, the taxpayers have to pay for, in essence, trying to retrieve this program. Why should the taxpayers have to pay 100% of the contributions? Why shouldn't the employees have to pay half? Does it reduce their income? Yes, it does. And it's a deferred program. They're going to get the retirement later. Many of you, I'm sure, would love to have a retirement account that pays a portion of your salary on and on forever, as long as you should live, and have somebody pay for it. But I submit to you in the end how these programs are managed has in part to do with whether or not they've got skin in the game. And all we're saying is we'll pay half. And there are many employers that would say, you've got a plan, it's underfunded, you pay it all. We're paying half.
Further discussion? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I can't really speak to other private employers, but I can tell you that I pay 100% of my medical and I pay 100% of my retirement. And I do that basically because I have to compete with not only state but other private employers. Either way that this goes, I think we don't want to lose track of the big picture about the need of this bill, and I don't want to get off in the weeds to the big need, but I do want to take a slight privilege of the floor and tell everybody that you requested a lot of information on retirement. I want to say it's in your email. It's from an email from Polly Scott. There's a PDF file there, and there's also a link, and that should answer any of the questions that you had about this bill and may answer some questions about this particular amendment. I will say that the discussion about why we went originally, with the state paying 100% of it, was essentially with the argument that it was cheaper for the state in the long run not to pay the FICA, and it's cheaper for the employee not to pay their share of the FICA. So the aggregate sum, if you vote for this amendment, will probably go down somewhat. If you vote against this amendment, the aggregate sum paid by the employer, by the employee and the employer, will probably go up somewhat by essentially FICA, which is about 15%.
Further discussion? You ready for the question? All those in favor of third reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 250 say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Amendment has failed. Vision has been called for. All those in favor, please stand. In favor.
You don't want to stand.
All those opposed, please stand. Amendment has failed. Third reading amendment number 2, House Bill 250. The reading clerk will read it in.
House Bill number 250, third reading amendment number 2, delete the Hastert third reading amendment.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move third reading amendment number 2 to House Bill 250. And I bring this amendment forward for a couple of reasons, Mr. President. One is by defeating the previous amendment and going with my original amendment, what we've done in the retirement bill for the first year, which will go into effect this fall, is that the state pays half and the employee pays half. This bill also includes another 1.5% increase that will occur a year from this fall. That increase is paid 100% by the state. So all what I want everybody to understand is if you divided that 1% up as far as the increase that goes into the retirement plan, 1/4 of that is paid by the employee, 3/4 of that is paid by the state. So we're 50-50 in this year that we're going into with the amendment that was defeated earlier and the amendment that was put on yesterday stayed on. What this amendment does, it looks at the second year, just so you know that the second year the state is picking up 100%. And I bring this to you for your discussion. And what it means, Mr. President, if the body was to move forward on this one, that, in fact, if it passes, that you would have the employees paying 1.93% into the retirement plan, and the state 13.19%. So I want everybody to understand this is saying that the second year of the retirement bill, that it would be split 50-50 as well as now what's passed the first year. I just want everybody to understand that, you know, vote it up, vote it down. If we don't pass this, we're going to be paying 100% that second year. If you do, we're splitting it.
Discussion?
Question?
Senator Scott.
Yeas and nays, please, Mr. President.
Yep. Yeas and nays have been called for. Any further discussion, Senator Landon?
Well, thank you, Mr. President. Just real quickly, that I guess that's exactly what I was alluding to when I stood up before, which is, you know, I just think that we all need to think about, you know, what is the picture for the public employees as we move forward. And we either choose to go this route, which the senator from the East explained why the state did that a few years ago. A lot of the new public employees didn't have anything to do with that. But we either take care of a retirement fund and give them less cost of adjustment increases, which is exactly what we've been doing, or we cut this in half for next year, and that's fine. If that's the policy decision. But Lynn, at some point, I hope we can get back into talking about, are we ever going to have, you know, a cost of living increase for some of these, especially the young public administrative employees that have come on board, and our young teachers out there with young families. you know, we got to go home this year and basically say, well, we didn't make any ground for you at all. You lost ground. And next year, that would be the case again. So that's all I'm saying. I mean, we cut back on the retirement fund. I hope we're willing to at least talk about the compensation in a bigger way.
Further discussion. Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Just very briefly. With 2% inflation, the salaries of these individuals will erode in purchasing power by that 2%. We're taking away 2% more right now. And with the loss of the federal payroll tax, 2%, our public employees are going to lose 6% of their purchasing power of take-home pay this year, whether or not we pass this amendment. We've already done that. Now we're trying to make sure that we get a little something extra next year. And I'm just wondering at what point we are going to start giving something back and recognize that we can't keep eroding the purchasing power forever without these good public employees leaving the state of Wyoming.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, when we talk public employees, let's just be careful on how we designate this. This is only state employees. We have a lot of public employees employed with small municipalities, counties, special districts. They don't fall under this category. They're already paying 50% in their retirement plans. They're kicking that in. Well, I wonder when we have this opposition, it's only for this selected class of public employees, your state employee. But I don't see this concern for all these other local government employees out there that are already paying 50-50. So I just bring this to the body's attention right now. This is just carving out, saying that if you work for the state, the state's going to pick up all your retirement program, even your employer contribution and your contribution. But if you're a local government, well, you guys just go ahead and pay your half because you're not special like the state employees. So when we throw out the word public employees, I think we need to be very careful and identify what public employees we're talking about here that are going to benefit under this plan.
Any further discussion? The ayes and nays have been called for. Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson, District 2?
Aye.
Anderson, District 28?
No.
Barnard?
No.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Christensen? Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
No.
Kraft?
No.
Dockstetter?
Aye.
Driscoll?
Aye.
Amrick?
Aye.
Esquibel?
No.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
No.
Hicks?
Aye.
Hines?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Landon?
No.
Meyer?
No.
Nicholas?
Aye.
Nutting?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson? Rothfuss?
No.
Schiffer?
No.
Scott?
No.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Ross?
No.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 17 ayes, 13 noes.
By your vote, second reading amendment number 2 to House Bill 250 has passed. House Bill 250, having been read 3 separate times. The question is, shall the bill pass? Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson, District 2?
Aye.
Anderson, District 28?
Aye.
Barnard?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Christensen?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Kraft?
Aye.
Dockstetter?
Aye.
Driscoll? Amrick,
aye.
Esquibel,
aye.
Geis,
aye.
Hastert,
no.
Hicks,
aye.
Hines,
aye.
Johnson,
no.
Landon,
aye.
Meyer,
aye.
Nicholas,
aye.
Nutting,
aye.
Perkins,
aye.
Peterson,
aye.
Rothfuss,
no.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Von Flatern,
aye.
President Ross,
aye.
Closing vote. Anderson, District 28, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 22 ayes, 8 noes.
Having received the affirmative vote of the majority members elected to the Senate, House Bill 250 has passed the Senate. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we're at that order of business consideration of bills on general file. And do you have an announcement before we start general file? We have a letter from the governor with regards to bill signing.
Oh, I do have that announcement. Thank you. Folks, with respect to the bill signing, you've got a list on there. And if you would, with respect to the formal signing ceremonies, if you would either email Ruth Crutchfield in the governor's office that you would like to have one, you know, in many instances, the governor gets a whole stack of bills. He wants to make sure every bill gets a formal signing, if that's what you'd like. Some of them will be pretty obvious. They'll have the signing process. But if you have a bill that's out, and if you would contact Ruth at her telephone number or the email address, it'd be helpful. That way, you know that there's going to be a ceremony. If you want confetti, you want balloons dropping down, that takes a little bit more work. You're going to have to do a little more extra to get that. In any event, they would like a heads up so to make sure that your bills get the appropriate ceremony.
Thank you.
With that, Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself into committee of the whole.
You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. Senator Hines.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 69. Read it. Clerk, please read it.
House Bill 69, Highway Funding, sponsored by the Revenue Committee, an act relating to revenue for transportation purposes. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highway, Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senator Escobel, Landon, Schiffer, Von Fladeren. No, Senator Cooper. Senator Von Fladeren, Chairman.
You heard the reading of the bill. It's your pleasure, Senator Von Fladeren.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a due pass on House Bill 69, Highway Funding. And to explain the bill, I will call upon myself. Fellow senators, I think you've all heard a little bit about this bill. It took a while getting here. For some of us, it's been 9 years, so you know, some of us have paid attention quite well and really wondered if it would ever get here. Long-term funding has been a continuous issue for YDOT. Every year we've appropriated, in fact, we've appropriated $600 or $700 million over the last 9 years for highway funding. But every year, the department would wonder if they're getting any money, what they can plan, what projects they can start or not start, depending on basically the whims of the legislature. So we're trying to get some kind of long-term fixed funding that they realize they can plan for. This bill will raise about 70-some million, of which one-third approximately goes to your local cities, towns, and counties. So about 40 million in state highways. Mr. Chairman, I'll run you through the bill real quickly. On page 2 is where you really need to start. We strike the word 14 cents. We're in the gasoline. So it goes from 14 cents to 24 cents a gallon. The reason that line 4, page 2, says there is levied and shall be collected a license tax of 23 cents per gallon of all gasoline used, sold, or distributed, is because 24 cents is what is collected and put to the road. But one penny equivalent of that is for leaking underground storage tanks. So not to raise that fee and end up actually having 2 cents going to leaking underground storage tanks, that's why there's a different number of 23 cents in little I, page line 4 through 8 on page 2. And then it goes into the distribution. Because the parks, because gasoline is burned in snowmobiles, off-road equipment, off-road vehicles, I should say, and boats, there must be a way to account for those people paying road tax. Because remember, road tax is what we're talking about here, and road tax gets applied to the roads only. But yet, if you use that gas, same gasoline, and put it into boats, off-road vehicles, snowmobiles, that money needs to be applied off the roads. And so they've done a calculation. The University of Wyoming has done their best 20-some years ago to figure out how many gallons approximately related to the number of snowmobiles, boats, and off-road vehicles that are registered, how many gallons approximately are used, should be dedicated to off-road trails, boat ramps, and water safety. And that's where you get into it on page 2, line 17, on down. They do number registrations, and they do it through a formula times $28. Used to be $16.25. This number was also raised proportionate to what the increase in the fuel tax is. So it went from $16.25 to $28.75. Will now be the new formula multiplier. And that takes care of page 3 where they go into motorboats, and they show you the value of $16.25 rising to $28.75. and a formula on how that is figured. And then you get down to page 4, the top of that, Romanet 4. This is off-road vehicles, and the formula has come up with $18.40 is the new value from $10.40. That is given to the Parks Department, state parks, and they put it for off-road trails, grooming snowmobile trails, boat ramps, and anything else related to the use of that fuel off-road. And then you get down into the diesel section, which starts on page 4. And once again, it goes from 14 cents to 24 cents. It mentions the 23 cents again because we're not raising the leaking underground storage tank value. We're putting all this new money to the roads. And then the rest of it is all conforming. Then we get into what the new part of this reports from YDOT. And demands that on page 5, line 15, little b, that any funds deposited to the highway fund which are attributable to the increase in fuel taxes under this act shall not supplant. They should only supplement. So they will be added to the existing. They won't take money they're already putting on the roads, either through the federal highway money or this fuel tax. They won't supplant those with this. They'll add to it. So that's a guarantee that this money will go to the roads and they won't cut some other area that they're now putting the funding to the roads. And then they have a report to do, which ends page 5, and the bottom of, or middle of page 6, line 6, says effective July 1st. So they have about 5 months, should this pass, 4 months, to put this into effect. And we all know the automation involved with fuel stations these days. It'll be a matter of, it's all collected at the rack, so it'll be a matter of the computer being reset at the rack to charge the appropriate amount of fuel tax at the rack. You have to also remember that this summer, a super committee was put together, which is the first one I do remember since I've been here. And that was a combination, of the Revenue and Transportation Committees. And when they met, they looked at several items that they thought they could raise to or could increase the funding source to pay for some of the roads. Remember, the YDOT is looking for about $135 million is what their estimate was, what they need every year to take care of the roads. Some of the Joint Revenue Committee and the Joint Transportation Committee, what they looked at was possibility of toll roads, raising registration fees, increasing some kind of, putting some kind of sales tax on fuel, overweight and oversized surcharges, registration apportionment fees, frontiers of electronic, looking at electronic monitoring, which would be value miles taxed, which is something, it's very complicated. Some people are trying it out in different states, but it's all experimental. And then raising the fuel tax.
They focused on the registration fees and the fuel tax. And the only reason they really considered the registration fees is they haven't been raised since 1975. I don't think we're going to see that bill. I don't know where it is. Couldn't tell you. But they said fuel tax. That's the one thing that is least likely to be shifted to the consumer, which I hope to be able to show you. I'm sure you've made up your mind, most of you, on how this is going to go, but I really want to be able to show you that shifting to the consumer is probably not going to happen. And I'll show you where the money is collected and why, through some empirical data, why I can comfortably say that less than half of this will ever make it to the consumer. One of the other things they considered was that 53% of the fuel tax is paid by out-of-staters. That's something to really consider. The ones that are using our road are paying for our roads, or helping to pay for our roads. And they figure that only 20 to 25% of the actual of Wyoming households, 20 to 25% of the money collected will actually be from Wyoming households. You got 53% being paid by non-residents. You have the commercial aspect of this state paying about 30% of it, and that difference being paid possibly by households. And then there is considerable evidence, and this is what I want to bring forth to you. I want you to be able to explain this to your constituents. There is considerable evidence that we are already paying this increase, and we need to see how that comes about. And also, question on 24 cents. Why is it 24 cents and not 30 cents and not 18 cents? The buying power, as estimated through inflation, the buying power in 1998, the last time we raised this, at 14 cents, the buying power today is equivalent to 24.8 cents, hence the increase of a dime to 24 cents. We're not increasing their buying power. We're just trying to stay up with inflation. And that's average cost of living inflation. That is not construction inflation. At one time in the last 7 or 8 years, the price of oil, which is what the price of oil that they use to create pavement, actually went up 6 times in 1 year. The value of 600% rise in 1 year. We never accommodated for that. There was a lot of contractors caught by that sudden inflation, and the state worked with them, and we sort of resolved it. It's come down some since, but it's at least 4 times. 3.5 times is what they figure construction costs are today versus 1998. So what I'd like to do is quickly go over these three graphs, these three sheets of paper you have on your desk. The first one's a graph. What it's showing you is since the first quarter of 2009 through the fourth quarter of 2012, the top two lines, the red and blue line on this graph, are the rack price of fuel within 100 miles of our border. So this is Wyoming and surrounding states rack price. The rack price is where they load the over-the-road truck with the fuel to be delivered to the retailer, where we collect all the fuel taxes. So you don't collect the fuel tax from your local convenience store. The fuel tax is collected at the rack. So when it's loaded in the truck headed to the gas station, fuel tax has already been paid. You'll notice the red and blue line, and you can barely make out the blue line underneath, is the average rack price for diesel fuel in Wyoming and the average rack price for surrounding states. That's those two top lines. You see, they stay right together. It hardly ever changes. Now, that includes all the fuel tax. So you'd have to wonder why Wyoming's at the rack price isn't a dime less than a state around surrounding us that charges 24 cents, 14 cents more for fuel, and some are 16 cents more for fuel. The two lines underneath that are the average of a rack less the tax. So whatever they paid at the rack, $2 or $3, minus our dime, or our 14 cents, minus Colorado's 22 or Nebraska's 24 or 26 cents, shows you the difference. Well, the difference is 10 cents. That's the difference between their tax and our tax. Very simple math. We're already paying exactly the same price at the rack for a regional product. And then, of course, you take the tax off, we're paying more for our fuel. Well, somebody's collecting that difference. And what it really amounts to, and that's the second page, which an economist put this together, so I won't go into great detail on that. I wouldn't want to lose anybody. But what it really amounts to is that the marketer, the one that paid it, takes the fuel from the rack to the retailer, can go to an out-of-state or surrounding state of ours, knowing that he has 1,000 gallons, and this is what this next one says, next page. It says, I got 1,000 gallons I'm selling in Wyoming and 1,000 gallons I'm selling in South Dakota. But I'm making an extra dime on that same fuel in Wyoming. So I can go to the retailer that I'm trying to lure to buy it from me versus my competitor, and I can offer him 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cents a gallon discount because I'm making it in the Wyoming side. So in reality, showing you that we pay the same price at the rack, which is where the taxes are paid, since we're paying it there, he has that dime to fudge on the surrounding states to give them a discount on how much he sells it to them. So if you follow this whole down, and I can answer questions later because I don't think, what you really see is a nickel. If we raise our fuel taxes to 24 cents, matching most of our surrounding states, you'll see that we will see as much as a nickel difference, as much as, and this is if it's all taken out and given to the consumer, because he's lost that dime he can fudge with the neighbors. We're no longer subsidizing the retail price over in another state. It may rise as much as a nickel, and that may be possible, but that isn't even, we don't believe that's even possible. It's a marketplace-driven price. There's no reason that Rapid City is 20 cents less than us unless the market's setting that price for them. And I hope, you know, most of us believe in the market running the prices, so we're trying to stay out of the way of that. This last page is really important. This is, and I can guarantee you some of our professional map makers had nothing to do with making this map. This is what you get a map when an economist draws his own map. So, but what if you can picture this, and our good senator from Lander is not giving me staring at me too hard. You can picture this. You see Wyoming, and that black line across the middle is really supposed to be I-80. So, use your imagination. So what happens is Nebraska has a 26.5 cent fuel tax. So there's this mythical fuel station that sits right on the border with Wyoming. And that driver fills up 500 gallons. He's going to drive. He's got lots of tanks. He's driving all the way to California with his load. He loads up in Nebraska. His account, what is called IFTA, International Fuel Taxes Agreement, his account, sitting in wherever that is in the world, gets dinged 500 gallons times 26 or 0.265 cents, and his account shows he has like $130 built up in this account that he owes Nebraska. But he pulls right onto I-80, and he never uses Nebraska roads. He drives 402 miles across Wyoming. He continues across Utah, Nevada, into California. Well, he makes a report. All interstate truck drivers make this IFTA report. And he reports 402 miles driven in Wyoming. We only charge 14 cents. We've given him a 12, it's divided by 6 miles, 6 miles a gallon. So 67 gallons he reports burned in Wyoming. We've given him a 12.5 cents credit because he's only being charged 67 gallons times 14 cents. So his count's holding 12.5 cents credit. If he was to park in Evanston and shut it off, he'd actually get a check back from IFTA. His IFTA account would be showing they owe him money. So then he drives through Utah at 24.245 cents, 24 and a half cents a gallon's their fuel tax. He's still making 2 cents on credit. His account, which was at $132 when he began this adventure, is still only down to 107 now. Then he drives across Nevada. Nevada's 0.278, 27 and 8 tenths of a cent per gallon. So then he's actually losing 1.8 cents, 1.3 cents. He's actually paying more in Nevada, and then Nevada gets a check for more fuel. He's down, clear down to $88.45 left in his account. And then he drives X distance in California, which is charging 40 cents, 40 and a half cents a gallon. And then he finally extinguishes that account. So in reality, we are giving him a credit. If he had all driven all in Nevada, Nebraska would have gotten a check for all 500 gallons times $0.26.5. But since he drove across Wyoming and reported it here, we only charge him 14 cents. That's all we get times 402 miles or 67 gallons. So we actually are, he's paying more for his tax, fuel tax, than we're collecting for him. So with that in mind, by bringing our taxes up, him using our roads, we will at least get 24 cents. We still give him a 2.5 cent every 6 mile credit if he fueled up in Nebraska. But at least we're getting a bigger share of it. You got to remember, when I talk about the regional rack prices and how we're all connected, there's 245 people that pay into this tax, 245 wholesalers that pay us via the rack to this account for fuel tax. When they collect it, they send the check to the state. Only about 51 of them have Wyoming addresses. So you have 290 or 190-some non-Wyoming addresses. That's how regional this is. When they fill up at Sinclair, they fill up in up by Sheridan, just south of the town of Sheridan. That same fuel paying that same price may end up in Montana. When they fill up at Newcastle, they may end up delivering to a station in South Dakota, but they're paying the same price at that rack. And the same for us. We may go all the way to Billings and fill up a tanker headed that may come all the way to Wyoming, but it may stop in Montana, but the wholesaler paid the same price at that rack. So in reality, we are paying, we probably empirically through the data on that first graph, which is taken right from API and OPIS, Oil Price Information Services, says that you're already paying it. We're just not collecting it. So with that, oh, one more thing I'd like to show you. We also have a fuel tax fax. If you have any questions about how the tax is distributed, how YDOT's budget runs, what the taxes in the surrounding states are, they're all inside the fuel tax. Fuel tax fax. And I will point out that Save the Wyoming Roads, which is a black folder you have on your desk. Within that is a sheet that shows all the businesses, including the Trucking Association, Taxpayers Association, Travel Industry, 18 different organizations that have signed on. These 18 organizations are probably 40,000-some people in total, including the one person with his truck that belongs to this organization, to the major truckers. The Economic Development Associations in our state are on this list. So even though it's only 18 organizations, you're looking at thousands and thousands of Wyoming employees, most of which are your constituents. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I've explained the bill without taking all night because I know you have many volumes of information on this, and I stand for questions.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. One, you mentioned that 53% of this would fuel tax would be paid by someone from out of state. Now, I need a little clarification whether that's just diesel fuel. Is that the blend of the diesel fuel and the sale and the gas tax? If it is just the diesel fuel, the 53% that's paid by out of state, do you have a number that says what gas taxes as far as the percentage paid for in-state and out-of-state is? A little discussion about the fiscal note here where we've got 1.269 or essentially 1.27 or so plus that doesn't get to any roads at all, special revenue. I believe these are in areas that go to snowmobile trails, four-wheel drive trails, and boat ramps. I'm curious as to the discussion we had about why all other parts of state government is taking an 8% hit, yet these special interest groups are able to substantially increase their funding from essentially around $2 million to well over $3 million, so 30 to 40% increase in these areas, and why they deserve a 30 or 40% increase while all other state government is taking an 8% decrease. I'd really be interested in that discussion. Maybe some discussion about the difference between the distribution between sales, between the taxes, between fuel and gas going back to local entities, how that's differentiated. I believe there's a gas tax and diesel fuel to local governments is a different distribution formula. Maybe something to give us an idea about that. And after those, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure somebody else will have some other discussions or questions.
Senator Hicks.
Chairman, that read in at this time.
Okay, the reading clerk will read in the committee of the whole amendment.
House Bill 69, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 1, line 2.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment 1 to House Bill 69. Members of the committee, I couldn't have done a more articulate job as to why we need this Standing Committee Amendment than the good chairman or the good senator from Gillette. Let's just talk about what this amendment does, and then I want to use the information that he provided to tell you why this is a necessary amendment. Basically, what this amendment does, I'm not going to go through line by line. I'm just going to describe what this does. It just sets the tax back to exactly what it is today, except for the diesel fuel tax that would be assessed against large trucks. What this effectively does is says in this amendment that we're actually going to increase the diesel tax to get to the good issues, the issues that were already articulated about how the state's losing the money. What this effectively does says is if you dispense diesel fuel through a large nozzle or through a facility that is designed for large trucks, you will be assessed a 30% diesel fuel tax. If you have a facility that dispenses diesel fuel through your local come-and-go, like your gas station that doesn't have the large nozzle and is not designed for large semis, that diesel tax would stay the same. Well, let's talk about what that does, and I'm going to use the example that we just saw here. Under this scenario, if we raise our diesel fuel tax on trucks, and that's what we're talking about, because a lot of the testimony and the information that I saw that YDOT put out, that one 80,000-pound semi going across I-80, and we know that I-80 is the one where the big problems exist as far as trying to finance that cost. That's where we're expending a lot of those funds, is on that interstate. Well, if we pass the diesel fuel tax as it is in the current proposal, we're still losing money. Because if you filled up and you use the example in Nebraska, 26.5 cents, and you drive across Wyoming, we're still crediting those guys. They're still getting that credit for that extra 2.5 cents. So we haven't even brought up that to parity with the adjacent states based on the distribution of sales tax. Now, the next question that comes out is why aren't we at least getting the equivalent of what our adjacent states have? This bill gets at this. And some people will come back and say, well, if we do this, then the trucks aren't going to fill up in Wyoming. And I think what the good senator from Campbell County already said, it doesn't matter. They're going to pay the tax. If they show on their logs that they drove across the state of Wyoming, they are going to pay a proportional amount of that tax. Now, the good thing about that is I think with the fuel taxes, the good senator also pointed out that the truckers' associations are all for increasing diesel fuel tax. But if we go back to the first graph that was handed out, to the committee. Basically, it says it's not going to reduce consumption at all if we set the tax to 30 cents. The same argument's valid. This is not going to be showing up on the consumer. But the point being is here, is the cost of maintaining our roads and what's driving the cost up is the heavy truck traffic on our interstate system. It's not maybe be a solve-all for what YNOT needs to fund the highways adequately, but let's have some parity in our taxation. If one large truck that weighs 80,000 pounds is the equivalent of 3,500 or 4,000 passenger vehicles, why are we taxing them at the same rate? Why are we doing that? This gets us down the road. It gets to the issue of providing some surety that for YDOT that's going to have some funds to start developing reconstruction, resurfacing programs on I-80. That's what this bill does. Members of the Senate, I'd ask for your favorable consideration on this amendment.
Senator Scott, and we're on committee of the whole amendment number one, not a standing committee amendment.
Mr. Chairman, on and for this amendment. Mr. Chairman, the sponsor of the amendment is exactly right. The big cost to maintaining our highways and in building them, because you have to make them a lot more robust if you're going to have big trucks, is what the large trucks do. And this amendment introduces an element of fairness into our taxation system. We have always recognized, Mr. Chairman, that the large trucks will cost more. And what happened historically was that we had a thing called the ton-mile tax that did assess them, but it had all kinds of problems with it. And we repealed it, and we replaced it with higher registration fees. And those hit our local truckers. But what happened was those registration fees are apportioned on the interstate truckers, and the larger ones of those travel a tremendous number of miles, and what Wyoming got through the apportionment was a relative pittance for those folks, not for the local Wyoming truckers, but for the interstate ones. And this amendment would reach and capture those people and make them pay their fair share. And I think that, Mr. Chairman, is an essential element if we're going to increase the funding here as we need to. It certainly transforms me from a no vote on the bill to an aye vote, because I think it does produce a big element of fairness in the bill, which I think it lacks as it stands before us right now. So I rise to support the amendment and urge its adoption.
Senator Schiffer.
Amendment. There's some real problems in this amendment. Structurally, it's unsound. We don't levy the tax at the pump. The pumps aren't geared to levy a tax. We levy the tax at the rack. Now, if you want to make every service station owner go out and buy a machine to dispense diesel fuel, and get a sales tax number and keep track of it, you can do that. You'll drive his expenses up. And maybe that's what you want to do. But we do not levy the tax at the pump. It's done at the rack. We are not equipped to tax at the pump, nor do we want to be, in my opinion, and I hope in yours when you vote this down. Second thing, all this talk about I-80, well, we got three interstates in this state. And guess what? I'm in the cattle business, same as my colleague from Natrona. I'll load no more than 50,000 ever on a load. That's the gospel, folks. It truly is. But anyway, I load them up to the max and then a couple more. And I go out my road, which I own. I got to maintain that. And I'll go first to a county road, then to a state road, then to a state-federal combination, 191, then on to an interstate, I-25. And I may go on and off that system. If I send them to California, they'll go to Nevada first. They'll go right down I-25, cut off at Casper. And you know the route, you know. It's a system, folks. It isn't I-80 gobbling up everything. We all use all the private roads, the county roads, state roads, the state national, and the interstates. And it's a system. And we need that system. That's the beauty of what we're proposing here today. To say that I-80 should pay for all the road system in Wyoming, I don't believe is right. I don't believe it's good for us as a state. The second thing is, what you're really doing is asking trucks to go over I-70, go to Colorado.
And, you know, you can say what you want about the wear and tear on the highway, but truckers do spend money. Tourists spend money. When they go through I-80, when they're tired of looking at sagebrush, they'll stop at, I don't know where, Rawlins or one of those towns, and buy, I don't know, whatever they're going to buy. But they do spend money, and they are part of a system we use of transportation, and it's got to be a statewide system, and it's got to be something that will cover the costs that we all pay into. That's what is known as a user fee. If you want to get away from a user fee, vote for this. It won't work. You're putting a hell of a burden on your fuel dispensers. But the way the tax is structured now, it is a user's fee, pure and simple. And so I urge you to defeat this amendment.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a problem with this amendment regarding those people. We are after the truckers, or that's what apparently this amendment's after. But what about those people who have diesel pickups and diesel vehicles that they originally bought for the gas mileage on them? We're going to this seems to be punitive toward them, and we're kind of springing this on them. It seems to me that without this amendment, the bill is much fairer.
Senator Rufus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm against the amendment. Mr. Chairman, we set up this super committee, a combination of two of our fine committees here in the Senate, to spend the interim working on what they considered to be the best solution for the state of Wyoming. They worked hard on that. They had a tremendous amount of input from the public. This is what they came back with. They came back with their recommendation of legislation that is reasonable. It's a hard piece of legislation, obviously, but they gave us their recommendation. And I think we're going to have to respect that. I have great ideas, too. I could fiddle with it. But that's what it is. It's fiddling with it at that point. A lot of work went into this joint committee bill. I'm going to support it as it is. I hope the body will also. I'm going to resist amendments to it. I do believe some of the concerns that the good senator from Carbon County has raised are valid, that we need to look for ways to ensure that we have a perhaps more equitable investment in our highways and infrastructure from the larger trucks. But I would say that would be something for next year or for the following year, where we can look to maybe a modernized ton-mile tax or something along those lines. But this is certainly not the time to scrap the fine work of this super committee that we put together and replace it with something that was arrived at without committee consideration and without the input of the entire state of Wyoming that we've seen over the last several months. So, against the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to rise in favor of this amendment. I would say, as far as what we've just heard about the public input over the interim on this bill, I would suggest to you the public input was pretty, from the general public, was pretty slim. Most of the public input came from big industry and those people or organizations that had an interest in the amount of money that they were going to get from this. So as far as the public goes, a lot of them didn't know about it until late on. Yeah, we had committee meetings and they were public, but there wasn't a whole lot in the news media. As far as the distribution to from this money from this, the distribution would be good for both state, local, and local governments with this. And one of the things it does, it also cuts out all those funds that are in this current bill to go to things like snowmobile trails, off-road trails, and those things like that. This distribution would just be 75% to the YDOT, 20% to the counties, and 5% to the cities. And that's the way the distribution is on diesel fuel. As far as accommodating the delivery process to those type stations that handle these large nozzle operations, I think the delivery process could take care of that as far as the tax goes, and understanding that the fees for the fuel tax come from those who deliver it from the rack, that be easily accommodated through that delivery process and through the truck system, bring it to those. And it's interesting, we heard that this is a user's fee maybe on the people that drive trucks across the interstate here, and they may end up going down south to our friends on I-70. It was kind of interesting, just before that, a few minutes ago, we heard that, oh, by the way, You'll never feel this tax. The public won't feel it. They won't see it. It'll all be consumed into this magic economic formula that's a distribution system throughout the region. So now we hear, oh, but by the way, they will feel it if we put this tax on. So I'm not sure where we're at on this. I don't know whether the public are going to feel this tax or not feel it. But I'd be opposed to this. I mean, I would be in favor of this amendment. Excuse me.
Senator Distler.
Mr. Chairman, thank you on and for this amendment. I, too, find it interesting on the interim committee. If we're fiddling, Nero was a legislator. You know, that's what amendments are. They're fiddling. They change bills. They do it for a reason. This is a good one. As far as the distribution and how it goes off the rack, this works well. The small nozzle tanks are in a separate tank. There may be a few that pump out of the same, but I doubt it. Most of them are on a separate tank. You've got a small nozzle. Those pickups and trucks you were talking about, the little smaller ones, we all fill in those. I drive a little diesel Volkswagen Beetle. Most of you guys know that. Big nozzles won't even fit in it. Got a little one. That's what this bill's for. It allows those guys to still get what they need. The big trucks get the big nozzles, and it can be taxed. It's a pretty simple way to split it. And we really are. We're talking user fees. And that's the trucks are the ones. It's going to raise my freight rates. Same thing. I never load an extra cow either. We'd never overload a truck on our place. But I don't mind paying the extra little bit, whatever it be, on the damage the trucks do. Trucks are what does the damage. And this does. This makes the bill truly an honest bill that makes the users pay for who it should be paying. I urge you to vote in favor.
Senator Landon.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to save some what I think are pretty good points for the bill itself, but we dove off into the bar pit, and we're talking about something that really hadn't been vetted very well. So I'll spend some really good time on a not very good amendment. You know, I think a lot about my dad. You know, he came home from World War II, and he was one of those guys, and we've all got parents, I think, who contributed too, but he was one of those guys who helped build this state. I'm really proud of the work he did in the Game and Fish Department. Our fisheries and our wildlife are the much better for all the work he did. And I thought about this bill and him, and I thought about him pulling up to the pump in 1969. So I did a little homework, and I went back, and I looked at what he would have paid for a gallon of gas. And he paid 25 cents. And you know how much tax he paid on that gallon of gas? 7 cents. And you know what that would equate to these days? 84 cents. So when you hear that the greatest generation contributed to the infrastructure and built this country, it's true. They did. They cared about it, and they put the money where it needed to go, into our economy and into our roads. And today we're sitting here on an amendment that says we don't want our cars to pay anymore. Again, still. You know, ever since I got down here, I've served on your Transportation and Military Affairs Committee, Mr. Chairman, and I've been happy to do that. I've worked really hard to try to get my arms around all of these facts and figures. 2008, we brought a bill, it failed. 2009, we brought three bills, and they all failed. 2010, that one failed too. 2011, a phased-in fuel tax, that failed. 2012, we failed two more bills. You know, back when Dad pulled up to that pump, and he paid 7 cents on a 25-cent gallon of gas, you know what he paid earlier that year for his vehicle fee? $15. You know what we pay today? $15. Folks, it's time. It's time for us to step up and do what's right. This bill has been properly vetted. It's the best option. It's going to benefit our local communities. It's going to benefit our highway system. We can get back some other time to talking about whether or not the trucks who, by the way, pay higher fees, higher registration fees, and they buy 500 gallons of diesel fuel at a time. This isn't a good amendment. Let's get rid of this amendment, get back on the bill, and do what we need to do. Thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we've had a good discussion here, and we're really looking at, I think, in this bill is something that is more of a user fees. And if you look at the average weight of a car now, and the statistics that we're citing here, 3,500 to 4,000 times more impact with a truck than a car, because cars are lighter, you know, you could probably go to 4,000 to 5,000 times. You could probably drive 5,000 miles across this state in a car and have the same damage as a truck because our cars are getting lighter and they're getting more fuel efficient. You know, Mr. Chairman, this indeed is a user's fee. There's no doubt about it. It's putting the money in the tax system with the people that are causing damage to our roads. And in all deference to the super committee, you know, folks, there are a lot of select committees and super committees, and they'll bring legislation, and it goes through the process. And we're only in the first reading committee of the whole. And we have ample time, and we have vetted this amendment substantially. And this is really a good amendment because it goes to the problem. It goes to the problem. It is in fuel. And I didn't get the answer from the good senator from Campbell County because we moved into the amendment, but I'm assuming that fuel is probably paid a lot more by out-of-state folks than gasoline is paid by out-of-state folks because of our heavy truck traffic. One every 18 seconds, I think, across I-80. And this doesn't say that these are all going to go on I-80. I mean, and even if they do go on all I-80, there's not enough money in this tax to even take care of the damage that these vehicles do on I-80. So really, we are in the starting process of how to fund our roads through a user fee situation. And this really is just the first salvo. And we'll be back here next year. And we may indeed have to pass a gas tax, and we may indeed even have to raise this fuel tax again or do some other things. But this is a user fee, make no doubt about it, and it's going directly to the people that are causing the damage on all of our roads.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, if you will allow me to slowly claw my way up out of the borrow pit so I can see across the pavement to the good senator here from Natrona County, and I got to crawl my way up a long way because he's vertically challenged, so. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't know how far the good senator's dad had to drive for fuel, but let me talk a little bit about the parity and why I brought this amendment. I want to talk about my Senate district, and I don't know how far some of you guys have to drive your car or your small diesel vehicle to go buy groceries or go see the doctor. But let me give you a little rundown why I think there's some real disparity in the current tax policy in this bill that we have right now. I've got constituents that live in Rock River, and because they don't have a grocery store that is a full-supply grocery store in Rock River. So they drive to Laramie, 80-mile round trip to go get their groceries. Medicine Bow, that's another group that I represent. They go get no grocery store, no doctors, no facilities. 114-mile round trip to Laramie is the closest place. Elk Mountain, 92 miles. Hannah, 81 miles. Bear Oil, 75 miles. Riverside, 36 miles. Encampment, 38 miles. If you live in Wamsutter, you go to Rollins. It's 80 miles. If you live in Eden, you got to drive to Rock Springs. That's a 75-mile round trip. How about if you live in Farson, 82 miles to Rock Springs? Bags, they shop in Craig, Colorado, 82 miles to go to the doctor. Go get your groceries. Dixon, 96 miles. How many of you have to drive 96 miles or 114 miles or 80 miles to go buy groceries twice a month? Go to the doctor. So this one-size-fits-all fuel tax across the board doesn't fit. These are not user fees. This is a penalty fee. That's what this does. That's why this bill's here. That's why the amendment's here. Let's tax the people who are creating the problems. Let's don't penalize the people that are just trying to make a living here in Wyoming. With that, members of the committee, I'd ask for your favorable consideration on this amendment.
Ready for the question on the bill? Amendment, excuse me. All those in favor of Senator Hicks' motion to adopt the committee of the whole, number one, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The amendment had failed. We're back on the bill. Division been called for. All those in favor, please stand. Those opposed. The amendment have failed. We're back on the bill. Question on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Von Fladen's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, they do so with a favorable vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The bill has passed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 65. The reading clerk will please read it.
House Bill number 65, Municipal Solid Waste Landfill Remediation, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, an act relating to public health and safety. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development,
yeah.
Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senator Anderson, 02,
well,
Senators Cole,
yeah.
Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss, Senator Hines, Chairman.
What is your pleasure, Senator Cooper? Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
You may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would the members of the Senate Appropriations Committee please go down to 204? We'll start work on the Joint Conference Committee report.
Okay. The reading clerk read House Bill 65. Senator Cooper.
Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises and reports, that it do so with a favorable recommendation that Senate File 65 do pass. And I'd like to yield the floor now to Senator Coe, who will explain the bill. There is no standing committee amendments. Uh-oh.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we'll have to pretend I'm Senator Coe. A question. And, Mr. Chairman, I was handed this bill about a minute ago, so bear with me as I walk you through it. Mr. Chairman, this bill is one of two products that came from the subcommittee that was put together to look at solid waste issues for the state of Wyoming in the interim. The two bills are complementary bills. This one that we're looking at now is focusing on issues that are in the past, effectively where we have remediation issues around the state because of improper lining, improper conditions, not setting up the landfill, not funding it correctly. And we have a lot of sites that have been identified around the state that are problematic. We've worked with the Department of Environmental Quality to assess those sites, determine some prioritization. They brought back to us some lists. We had some discussions during the interim based on how to proceed with that and what the best approach was going to be. This legislation tries to move that forward, and it establishes a program and a fund to address those concerns. Now, Mr. Chairman, as you remember, we've been funding for quite some time well, not quite some time, actually, just for the last couple of years, but in large quantities. The landfill remediation account that, depending on how things go after this legislative session, is going to have many millions of dollars in it. I believe we appropriated $30 million last time. We might well appropriate $30 million more, taking it up to around $60 million. But this is towards a problem that has been estimated at somewhere around $225 million over the next two decades. So our $60 million after this session, if that's what we have, is still just a start down that road. Looking at the bill and what it does, Mr. Chairman, on to page 2, we see that it establishes the Solid Waste Remediation Program. This program is administered by the Solid and Hazardous Waste Division of the Department of Environmental Quality. And what it does is that, it, as you can see in little B, the legislature recognizes the threat to the public health, safety and welfare, and the environment caused by pollution to soil and water from leaking municipal solid waste landfills. Now, that's the key here, is that we have these sites all around the state. These sites are problematic. They're leaking, and we need to find a way to address it. The hope in the past was that the municipalities themselves would be able to account for it, but that is not the case. We've heard through testimony that there's no way the water will be protected based on the funds that are available to some of these small municipalities, and that we needed to come up with a solution to protect that. So as you can see on beginning on line 14, this program, the purpose of it is to take state primacy of the Municipal Solid Waste Landfill Remediation Program and to provide funding to take remediation actions at eligible leaking municipal solid waste landfills. And basically the rest of this bill provides the details of that program. You can see at the bottom of page 2 going on to page 3 the program criteria, where the department shall contract with entities including contractors and local contractors to provide the monitoring and remediation activities, groundwater remediation and monitoring, methane mitigation monitoring, landfill capping, and other such operations at eligible leaking municipal solid waste facilities. And the key here is that the department shall oversee and fund up to 75% of the cost of the investigation, the installation, the monitoring, and the remediation for a period of up to 10 years. That period of time can be extended based on site-specific circumstances, but that's an issue that would then be discussed with the local operator and communicated beforehand. The department shall contract for monitoring and remediation activities under the program at leaking municipal solid waste landfills based upon the priority list of landfills that has been developed by the department. This is what it says under little B towards the bottom of page 3. Now, they've been working to develop this. They developed one previously. The task force asked them to go back and develop it based on a series of criteria. We'll get to that series of criteria in a little bit. But you can see on page 4 a discussion of the eligibility. The eligibility requirements require that there's be a written agreement with the department, that there be implementation and revision of the community's solid waste management plan to comply with all necessary regulatory obligations. We'll get into those in detail later on in the bill. That the municipality cease disposal of all waste streams at a leaking closed facility or the leaking portion of an operating facility. Moving on to page 5, Romanet 4, cease disposal into the units which do not have engineered containment systems or do not conform to performance-based standards. Now, this is a key consideration here based on how we do things in Wyoming. A lot of times you need to have a lined system, but we recognize that in certain cases, performance-based design standards suffice. That's reflected in this legislation. I know that's a point of consideration for many in this legislature based on what the community's needs are. We made sure that we reflected that consideration in this legislation. Romanet 5 indicates that we would agree, the municipality would agree to provide funding from any available funding source for at least 25% of the total costs, that they would control the releases of the source of pollution. And a key provision that goes on throughout this and the other piece of legislation is the concept presented in Romanet 7, which is that they must ensure continued revenue or funding streams sufficient to provide for all foreseeable costs of solid waste facilities under the control of the local operator or political subdivision. And then it provides some discussion about how that must account for operations, monitoring, recycling, closure, and post-closure activities. Romanet 8 goes on to indicate that to be eligible for this program, the municipality would have to be would begin to employ generally accepted accounting principles in managing all solid waste facilities, with recognition of liabilities associated with the closure and post-closure costs, the long-term cost of waste disposal compared to recycling, composting, or other diversion strategies. The theory between Romanet 7 and Romanet 8 is that we don't want this problem to occur again. So recognizing that the municipalities are incapable of funding the liability that they have at this point in time is one thing. We've accepted that. Moving forward, this legislation attempts to ensure that it doesn't happen again and that the true cost of the waste disposal must be accounted for at all times, off into the future, assuming remediation, whatever else is going to be required, diversion strategies, anything else, and that all of that accounting must take place and be demonstrated so that the municipality proves that they are not going to be in this same situation 20 years from now, coming back and asking us for additional money. That's one of the requirements, and it's an important requirement of this program. The bottom of page 6 discusses the department has the right to construct and maintain any structure, so it gives some rights and authority to the department. Page 7 talks about notification of the affected public of all confirmed releases required by the department. Little F requires or allows the department that they shall delegate and authorize a local operator to conduct or oversee monitoring and remediation under the program pursuant to a written agreement, as long as it meets regulatory requirements, and assuming the department shall approve the local operator's monitoring remediation plan. So it allows for local operators basically to contract with the DEQ when they know what they're doing at their own facility and provides for that. So even though the DEQ is going to have the primacy over this, they'll work with the local operators and allow them to do a lot of the work. Moving on to page 8. We see the creation of the account. Now, we've already been funding, basically, the money that's going to go into this account, but we're specifically naming it here. As you can see in the little A on page 8, there is created the Municipal Solid Waste Landfill Remediation Account, and then it talks about the fact that interest earned on this account shall be deposited into the general fund, which is typical. On to little B, discusses use and eligibility of the money, indicating that to be eligible, the owner or operator of the site shall comply with all the requirements in this program. Little C discusses reimbursement. The department shall reimburse costs incurred by a local operator who performed remediation and monitoring activities from the account if. Now, this is a point that led to a lot of discussion and debate in the interim when we had our three meetings of the subcommittee. There are operators that have had sites where remediation has had to take place since the DEQ has changed their policy basically back in 2006 and changed some requirements. So these localities have already been implementing this program, and they were hoping that the legislature would provide them with due credit for the remediations that they've done since they've been required to. After that discussion, this provision was put into place, and you can see there are some limitations on it, indicating that the eligibility would occur for those activities to be compensated for. Under circumstances, as you can see in Romanet 1, that there be a work plan for the remediation and monitoring activities submitted. Romanet 2, the remediation and monitoring activities were initiated between July 1st, 2006 and December 31st, 2012. That would be the time period where it would be reimbursed. That the local operator again agrees with the accurate accounting of the cost of remediation. Romanet 4, the local operator conducts additional remediation and monitoring activities at the leaking municipal solid waste landfill, which are eligible. And a key provision, as you can see in little D, that reimbursement shall not exceed for all reimbursements totaled under this this provision, $4 million. And that is not a random number. That's a number that was arrived at based on discussion by all of the municipal operators that looked at what they've done based on the changes to the laws in 2006 by DEQ and made that estimate as being the maximum amount that would be needed. Now, remember, that's just a matching portion, again, up to that $4 million. Romanet 2 indicates that for any one municipal solid waste landfill, an amount equal to the local operator's 25% share of the cost of remediation activities shall be eligible for funding. What that means, it's a little bit complicated, but it goes back to the fact that they're not getting money for this $4 million. It's an important concern. We're not handing money back to them. We're giving them credit for the money they spent, up to the 25% that they would have to spend if they were part of the program. No money is being handed back to them. It's that 25% match that they would have to make that we're giving them credit for, and that's a key provision. After that, on page 10, it talks about promulgating the rules and regulations to put this forward. You can see that that would include, at the bottom of page 10, providing for landfill monitoring and remediation, installation of all the monitoring standards and equipment. On to page 11, specifying the requirements for delegating the installation. Romanet 3 indicates establishing a procedure or procedures for reporting the release. Romanet 4 indicates inclusion of provisions under which priorities for remediation action shall be established. Again, this is a key provision that we discussed with DEQ about the fact that they have to have a good system for prioritizing. It's not just quantity of leak or severity of leak. They have to consider the cost efficacy of their program. You can see here then that the following factors will be included: funding availability, cost efficiencies, opportunities for increased cost sharing, timeliness of solutions, likelihood that the remedy will reduce risk, establishment of whether the facility has completed closure and transfer actions, requiring of records for compliance of repairs, creation of requirements for participation in the program for the return of the facility to local control, and specifying the standards for restoration of the environment. All of those would need to be included. Page 13, we're nearing the end, indicates the restoration standard, which is a standard established by DEQ that they shall restore, the municipality shall restore the environment to a condition and a quality consistent with standards established in rules and regulations. And then it provides finally a definition for eligible leaking municipal solid waste landfill, which indicates a landfill identified by the department under the priority list for municipal solid landfill wastes that need remediation created pursuant to the Wyoming statute as provided. And finally, Section 3 discusses transfers of money based on the previous allocations or previous appropriation, and then Section 4 gets us to the acts, the enactment of it immediately upon completion of all acts necessary to become a bill. That's the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Question.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, talk about a borrowed ish bill. This is probably one of the worst bills I've ever seen in my short tenure. Let me explain why. Having served on the local solid waste and disposal district for some time, I've seen this over the last progressive 10 or 15 years. Regulatory environment, the direction coming from the Department of Environmental Quality forced the whole state of Wyoming into what is a preconceived method of how we're going to deal with all the first, we tried to do it educational seminars and show people the regionalizations and the data was. We provided project grants. When they would do that, they came under their regulations. And all kinds of grants would hit us hard.
To when I look at this bill, and I understand the intent is, and the intent's good, but this is like coming in and confiscating a whole sector out there and make a state-run business. And what this bill effectively does, it says the state of Wyoming is going to operate every landfill in the state of Wyoming, and you'll be under our rules, our regulations, and our direction. The other thing it does is it sits here and pumps a tremendous amount of money into a consulting business. It says, you will hire a consultant. We'll hire a consultant. We're all going to do this. This is a total loss of local control by every form and fashion. I commend the department for trying to remediate underground leaking landfills. It's the right thing to do. But I see little hands in here of state control all over. I did hear last night, it woke me up, there was a bump sometime about 3 o'clock in the dark, and I'm pretty sure it was somebody from the Department of Environmental Quality in my room. But members, this needs to be taken back and relooked at.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let's
Georgia, take... floor leader.
Pardon me? You just said Mr. Georgia. Oh, that's... thank you. Mr. Chairman, with respect to the lines, paragraph or page 5, lines 1 through 3, as I read the bill, it simply says, if you already have a leaking facility, and those are the facilities we're saying, and these small communities have said, we've got leaking facilities, we need some help. And generally, frankly, it was a local problem, and you solve your problem. The state didn't create it. The locals ought to do it. And so we're trying to first determine what the rules are, where the state's going to come in and bail out a local community for making some bad decisions. And as I read this, it simply says, before the state of Wyoming is going to come back in and help you fix a leaking facility, you will not expand the facility with more cells and create more leaking. So why in the world would we go to a community who says, hey, we got a problem, we're contaminating our underground water, would you fix that, and then we're going to move to the right, the next cell next down, and we're going to continue the process? All this is saying is that if we're going to help you solve your problem, then you got to stop making the problem worse. That's all I see in there. That's not local control. It's not taking away, creating anything. It simply says before we put our money in, you stop making the problem larger.
Further discussion on House Bill 65?
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a really quick question. Going all the way to page 14, I wondered if the sponsor could just help refresh my memory. I thought that as we tackled this issue in 2011, that the concept was that we would put a fund in place off of which we would utilize dividends and interest. Is that not the case, or is this going to be something we will fund as we go? Or I thought I remember that we were going to try to put a permanent fund in place. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman.
Floor leader.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, all that happened here was the Minerals Committee identified approximately $180 to $280 million worth of existing liability in small facilities, principally small communities, where there was either an existing contamination problem or other problem that required a closure permit they couldn't pay for. And for years, we debated on the floor whether it's our responsibility or the locals. Why should the state have to pick up the funding obligations of the communities that made poor decisions or whatever? The first thing we did is directed the Minerals Committee is go back and figure out which of these really have to be closed with the expense. Our colleague from the South just expressed a view that we all had, and that is if we created a liability to do a closure permit for something that's not leaking simply because somebody in DEQ or elsewhere decided we ought to pay a lot of money to pay the consultants, we weren't prepared to pay those. So we asked the the Minerals Committee to go back and identify those which were the real injury or assault being taken against underground water. Then we said, okay, if the communities can't pay for it, maybe it's time to stop kicking the can down the road, identify the projects, and we'll start setting aside money for it. So we've been setting aside somewhere between, the goal was somewhere between 180 and 280, $280 million, to pick up the responsibilities created by others, not the state. And it was simply a recognition that in the end of the day, it's got to get taken care of if, in fact, there are leaking problems and the locals can't take care of it. So the dollar amount was not identified. We began setting aside the landfill reclamation account to accumulate funds to address the issue. And then we said, let's not spend any money, not a penny out of that, until we identify which of these facilities really has to be closed, really requires the funding, so we're not out just taking care of problems of small dumps that, frankly, communities would like to pass the cost on to the state. And let's figure out what the rules of the road are, because a lot of us in most of our committees are spending a lot of money for our trash pickup. And if all we're doing is saying, well, picking winners and losers so that some people don't have to pay for trash pickup and some do, we don't want to do that. So at least what I would hope is we pursue the path where we continue to accumulate funds of about whatever it is, $180 to $280 million. And we don't spend anything until we identify which ones require the money, why they require it, and make sure that we're only spending on funds that on these facilities that have to be closed because there's some groundwater contamination issue. Make sure the locals are doing everything they can do out of their pocket, and we become the remediation of last resort. And then we're simply taking it, regardless of how they got there. We live as a state, we die by a state, and we need to find a solution if those communities can't pay for it. So it wasn't an idea of a perpetual fund or things like that. Now, recently, you've heard a new theory, and that is to maybe take the LUS funds, because maybe we're ending the life of the LUS funds, and we can move that into a different type of funding, and that's an interesting idea. But this effort to set aside money was simply a recognition that somebody's got to take care of it, and some of these communities say, look, you can throw it on us. You can tell us to do it, but we will never, ever have the resources to do it. And we want to make sure we're not just cleaning up facilities that have no potential groundwater damage potential.
Question been called for. All those in favor of Senator Cooper's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it does so with the favorable recommendations on House Bill 65, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 65 have passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 71. Chief Clerk, or Reading Clerk, will please read the bill.
House Bill number 71, Omnibus Water Bill Planning, sponsored by the Select Water Committee, and Act relating to water development projects. It was referred to Committee number 5, Agricultural, State Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senator Emmerich, Geis, Hicks, and Johnson. Conflict, Senator Driscoll, Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard of the reading of the bill. What is your consideration, Senator Geis?
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move House Bill 71 do pass. And this is the planning water bill. We handled the construction a while back, and this is House Bill 71. And I have a handout, a cheat sheet you can all follow. And if you need more information, there's about 7 books or 10 books around here. Select Water Committee has one of these books. The Ag Committee has one of these books. So So there's plenty of information that you can get all that you want out of this. So we'll start right with tab 5, bill page 2. It's level 3. It's Belfouche River Watershed Study, Crook, Campbell County. We appropriated $350,000 to do that watershed, and that's on the Belfouche River. The next one is under tab A, page 2. That's the Black Fork Watershed Study, Uinta, Lincoln, and Sweetwater County, $350,000 to do that study. And that's over there around Fort Bridger and all that drainage that starts clear up into Utah, and all of that drains clear down into the Green River. The next one is on B, bill page 2, High Meadow Ranch Master Plan, Sublette County, $175,000 for a master plan. The next one is tab C, Lust Master Plan, Niobrara County, $200,000 for a master plan. Tab D, Osman Pipeline Master Plan, Lincoln County, $75,000. The next one will be tab E, Statewide Water Research, statewide, $400,000, and that's over at the university, and they choose these different studies, and then they report back, and some of them are good for us, and some of them are bad, but we need to hear both sides, and so that's why the money's put there, and then they pick what land and water development studies they want. And that's the end of level one, and that's, there's $1,550,000 appropriated to handle that side. Now we're in the level two studies. Tab F, Eaton Valley Farson Master Plan, Sweetwater County, $90,000. And what we're doing over there, we have a lot of salinity, and we can only let so much salinity to go in the Green River and on down into the Colorado River Compact, and so we have to keep our water cleaned up. The next one is the Hanna Water System. There's development over there around Hanna, and they need to look at their system and see what they can do to get it up to tough to take care of that little town. There's $100,000 in there. The next one is on tab H, Lower Norwood Water Supply, Washakie County, $75,000. That's the Lower Norwood. There's a bunch of ranchers down there that have poor water, and we have two systems. Ten Sleep has good water, and then the other system that goes to Worland, and we have to decide which system maybe we could pipe up for those ranchers, which is the cheapest way to go. The next one is Pine Haven Tank and Well Study. That's $100,000. That's over at Pine Haven. They're out there just east of Gillette. The next one is the Squaw Creek Water Supply, Teton County, $350,000. We've drilled a couple of test wells over there for this outfit, and they all come up short, so we're going down closer to the Snake River and see if we can find them some feasible water there. And that's the end of that one. And there's $715,000 appropriated in that area. The next one is level one rehabs, Interstate Canal, Beaver Meadows in Sweetwater County. That's $180,000, and that's all there is in that study, so that's $180,000. Now we go on down to level two project rehabs, Austin Well Reservoir Rehab, Uinta County, $280,000 feasibility study. Heart Mountain ID, Master Plan, Park County, $175,000. That's all of page one. Now we're on page two. The next one is tab MC, probable maximum precipitation, cool season statewide. We're looking at the precipitation statewide, and that's $250,000. And that's the end, so there's $250,000 in that, spent on that account. Now we're on level two projects, dams and reservoirs. We find that on tab N, Clear Creek Storage, Johnson, Sheridan County, $350,000 for reservoir to look at. I think that's Lake DeSmith, the one we're looking at there. The next one is tab O, Cottonwood Grass Creek Reservoir. That's in Grass Creek, and see if maybe there's a chance we might could put a small dam on that one. The next one is tab P, Shell Valley Storage, Bighorn County, $150,000. And that's a look at some wetlands, and that's studied in that one. Tab Q, Sublette County, Creek Reservoir, Lincoln County, $252,000 for a feasibility study. And the last one is on tab R, in West Fork Reservoir, Carbon County, $7 million permit and design. That's a stream down there that drops into the Little Snake, and there's a feasibility we might be able to build a dam there and store, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 acre feet in that. And so that's $7,822,000 total for that. In account one is $30,195,000. Tab two, or account two, $6,772,000. And account three, $8,072,000. So for next year, what we'll have to, for new projects, will be in count one, $16,473,000. Tab two, $2,946,000. And in account three, $119,540. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Discussion on the bill? Question being called for. Although in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 71, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. House Bill 71 have passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 102. Reading clerks, please read the bill.
House Bill number 102, Hospitalization of Mentally Ill Persons, sponsored by the Labor Committee, and Act Relating to Emergency Detention and Involuntary Hospitalization Proceedings. It was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Senators Kraft, Nutting, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Chairman, I move from the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with the recommendation that House Bill 102 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment I ask to be read in at this time.
Reading clerk, please read in the amendment.
House Bill 102, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 2, lines 20 and 21.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, this bill comes because the Management Council assigned to Committee Number 10 the job of looking at our involuntary commitment process. It's costing a good deal more than we had expected, and there's some problems there. Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to report the committee's about halfway through that study, and I would say about half the problem has been solved by the health department. They changed the management, the state hospital, made some other administrative improvements, and that's gone a long way. They haven't solved the whole problem, but they've made considerable progress. But the committee's work is only about half done. But one of the things at our meeting up in Lovell, Mr. Chairman, we heard a horror story from a family whose child, I think it was an adolescent child, acquired a mental illness, and often mental illnesses are expressed at about that age for the first time. And the child was put through the involuntary commitment process, and the parents were just cut out of it. And they were understandably upset and offended, and they came to the committee. And one of the members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, had had considerable experience with doing this, and he said, what are they doing using involuntary commitment for a child? You don't do it that way. In a progressive county, you send them through the CHINS process. It's much more family-friendly, and it works better. So the bill was drafted that way. And, Mr. Chairman, when it got to our standing committee, what we heard was that, wait a minute, there are some the CHINS process is in many ways a better process. It's designed to be family-friendly, to take the parents' wishes and views into consideration. Gets in many ways to the same point, if that's what's really needed. But the testimony we had was that there are a number of counties that still find the involuntary commitment process useful in dealing with adolescents. And the reason is that depending on which judicial district you're in, the involuntary commitment process may be quicker and surer than the CHINS process. And that if you're in a judicial district where that's true, and you have a child, Mr. Chairman, that is particularly acutely suicidal, you need to continue to have the involuntary commitment process available, because it may be the one in your locality that works best when you have to have it done right now on an emergency basis. And so what the committee did, and it really relates to the standing committee amendment, I believe, Mr. Chairman, that's been read in, has it not?
Yes, and it needs to be moved.
And I move the standing committee amendment. What the standing committee amendment does is it transforms the bill a bit, essentially as a compromise position, as if you look on page 2, lines 20 through 21, you'll see that the involuntary commitment proceeding section would apply only to patients who are adults. Well, what we said is, okay, we want to keep, because of the emergency nature on occasion, we want to keep the involuntary commitment process available for adults, but let's make it a good deal more family-friendly. That was the complaint we heard. So we take out that provision and substitute a new one. Proceedings under this section involving a minor, department shall, to the extent feasible, consult with the minor's parents and legal guardians. So they'll talk to the parents, and the parents are often in a shock. A child that has been perfectly normal suddenly has a schizophrenia or something like that, and it takes the parents some time to adjust. But we want to involve them. We want to bring them along, help them understand the situation they've got, and have them help us work out what's best for that child. So we hope to accomplish that with this new language. But because the other process through family services is better designed to be more family-friendly, where that can be used, we'd like to see that used. So we did not touch the language in the bill at the top of page 2, lines 2, 3, 4, that pushes them in that direction. So that's the compromise that we bring you, Mr. Chairman. That's the bill and the amendment. I'd be happy to answer questions on the amendment.
Question been called for on the amendment. All in favor of Senator Scott's motion to adopt the standing committee amendment to House Bill 102, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The amendment had passed. We're back on the bill. Those ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 102, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 102 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 156. Reading clerk will please read it.
House Bill number 156, Movement of Livestock in Emergency Situations. sponsored by Representative Hunt, an act relating to inspection of brands. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State Public Lands, and Water Resources, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks. Excuse, Senator Johnson. Senator Geis, Chairman.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move that House Bill 156 do pass. There's a standing committee amendment. I'd like to have that read in.
Reading clerk, please read in the amendment.
House Bill number 156, standing committee amendment number 1 to engross copy, page 3, line 14.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 156, yield the floor to Senator Emmerich to explain the bill.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we go through this bill, I'll bring the amendment in, and then we can catch that at the end. This bill is an emergency sort of bill that was brought about from the fires this last summer, and we anticipate that the fire season may possibly be as bad next year. But this act relates to brand inspection of animals when you have to move animals across a county line and there's a fire bearing down on you, and this gives you the emergency avenue to move these cattle and then report it to the livestock board for brand inspection and movement papers. This also applies to movement outside the state for health and brand inspection papers. And it's just, last year the director of the livestock board did order some emergency movement or allow some emergency movement of cattle. This just puts it in statute. And we're going through the bill. There is a little bit of cleanup. These are statute 11-2203 on page 1, brand inspection laws and how we go about inspection, when inspection is not required on the bottom of the page. Movement across county lines on page 2. And as we come to line 10, except as otherwise provided in this section, and this is relating to the transportation of cattle across county lines without having certificates, and it also pulls in the rustling statute on line 15. Moving on, it talks about who owns the cattle, but the real meat of the bill is on page 3 and goes through with notwithstanding other provisions. This allows a person, firm, partnership to move cattle across state lines, and then you have a 48-hour notice to call the brand inspector and legalize the movement. And this is where the amendment comes in, line 14, page 3, line 14. It refers to, in the case of an emergency situation declared or recognized by the board, the amendment removes board and inserts director, because the director can make that sort of decision in a much more nimble and flexible way than can the board, trying to get everyone across the state to agree to it. That same amendment comes in on page 3, line 23, and we're just substituting board for director, because the board does ultimately have the oversight of the director. On page 2, or on page 4, line 2, and on line 6, we once again refer to the director and not the board. And I'll stand for any questions. And Senator Geis has moved the amendment. I would.
Questions on the amendment? Question been called for. Those in favor of Senator Geis' motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 156, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Question on the bill? All those in favor of Senator Geith's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with their favorable recommendations on House Bill 156, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed. Our next bill for consideration is House Bill 172. The reading clerk will please read it.
House Bill 172, School Districts Leasing of Capital Assets, sponsored by Representative Stubson, an act relating to school district school facilities. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28. Senators Barnard, Cole, Landon, and Rothfuss. Senator Cole, Chairman.
Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, the whole rise and report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 172. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would move that at this time and defer to Senator Von Flatern to explain the bill and the amendment.
Okay, would the clerk please read in the amendment? Reading clerk.
House Bill 172, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 2.
Senator Von Flatern.
Mr. Chairman, and I believe that that amendment was moved, so I will insert it as I explain the bill. House Bill 172, the first lines, first page, really sum up what this bill does, an act relating to school district, school facilities, clarifying district use of capital leasing. Apparently, several years ago, the Attorney General, this bill is actually a little backwards. If you go down to the bottom of page 2 and you look at 2115-112 on line 12 through 19, the Attorney General several years ago opined that this was the only way school districts could do any capital leasing, any leasing at all. And this was this verbiage was taken right out of how we set up one of the prisons. And it works really well if you're looking at a multi-$100 million facility and you set up a nonprofit corporation for the state to pay into that actually takes care of the lease on the building. But this didn't work very well for any kind of enhancements that your school district may wish to lease. They're not dealing in that size of projects. They may also wish to lease something like buses, computers. If they have a new school, they may want to outfit part of the school through a leasing agreement. So this didn't work really well. What this bill does is, if you go to line 12 on page 2, it does clean up that the request must come from the school district. So they did go into the old statutes and clean that up a little bit, so it made more sense anyway. And because the request has to now come from the school district, and then upon approval by the Facilities Commission and the Attorney General. The original language had the school facilities being the requester, which the school facility never does request for enhancements. It has to come from the district. So this was cleaned up so it was almost palatable. And they threw the Attorney General in there because their office also goes over all leases to make sure they're legal and fit all the other codes and constitutionality of it. So then the new language, which is on page 2 at the top of little e, says, in addition to subsection A of this section, and to enable the districts to provide facilities, and this is where the amendment comes in. Amendment, Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to 172, goes to page 2, line 2, and after the provide, it inserts equipment, vehicles, or, and then moves down the line a little bit, deletes the ARE, and inserts maybe. So in addition to subsection of section and to enable the district to provide equipment, vehicles, or facilities, which may be excess of the statewide standards for the adequacy of school buildings and facilities, the school district board of trustees may use capital leasing authorized under 2115-112, and joint powers agreement, statutory trust, or other financing method authorized by law and approved by the Attorney General. So in other words, they can go in and actually lease equipment. Possibly if they're doing natural gas buses, they could do the additional expense of those buses waiting upon their state reimbursement. But this would allow for facilities thinking out of the box, maybe, because we have a sort of a cookie-cutter approach to how we build buildings, and if you want local enhancements, this is just one more option for you to lease those local enhancements and not have to have the cash on hand, which many of our districts would not have immediately, may have in the future as they get reimbursed for new schools to be open. But what this bill does is allow for that possibility of leasing. And for, with that said, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Senator Anderson, 28.
Mr. Chairman, just one question. Is this leasing or is this a lease purchase?
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I urge caution with this bill, and I'll tell you why, because we've had this discussion earlier in the session, and when you go out and you create a leasing option, it clearly is a financing option. There's no question about that. But I think we have to be careful here as we discuss how that lease is going to be paid for. We're talking enhancements here, where you do things above the statewide standards, and some of the concern I had in committee, although it came out of committee, was the fact that you can end up using operating revenues, which in fact is in the block grant, to service the leases that you have here in excess. Some of the bigger districts have the ability out there to be able to do that because they are able to, if you remember the discussion we had about reserves that were out there at one point in time. So from the court decisions, clearly, I don't think we can move forward so much with spending monies that are in the operating account. That's fully intended to be in the block grant. And so I have some concerns with this bill, and I would urge the Senate to use caution when they talk about this bill.
Senator Von Blaven. The question is, all those in favor of Senator Cole's motion to adopt the standing committee amendment to House Bill 172, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion passed. Senator Von Platerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the question of lease purchase, that could be included in this. That would be covered by that. And to address the concerns of the good senator from Cody, yes, I would agree that there could be some disparity between the large districts and small districts, but there exists today on their bonding capabilities. So this isn't doing anything that doesn't proportionally exist today. Now, whether you could use your operating expenses out of your foundation grant to pay on a lease, that's a possibility. But there's also things like rec mills and other income that the local districts have that they'd also be able to use this, to put towards this. That the way the language used to be written, they wouldn't even have that option. It was so convoluted in the way it was written before, and with the request having to come from the Facilities Commission versus the school district itself. So this cleans that up. Yes, I can't not argue against possible operating funds of a school foundation grant being used towards this, but once again, all I can claim is I hope they're paying their bills.
Further discussion? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Cole's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it does so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 172, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 172 have passed the committee of the whole. Our next bill for consideration is House Bill 188. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill number 188, Investment of Public Funds Interest-Bearing Deposits, sponsored by Representative Stubson, an act relating to public funds. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Senators Case, Emmerich, Peterson, Von Platerman, Senator Peterson, Chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so
with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 188. There were no standing committee amendments, and for further explanation on this good bill, I'd turn the time over to a good senator from Cody, Senator Cove.
Senator Cove.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. There's a handout I put out on a couple, well, yesterday, actually, that I'd ask that you maybe look at. But let me tell you about House Bill 188. The draft amendments are intended to build on the statutes adopted in 2006 that enable political subdivisions to purchase certificates of deposit through the Certificate of Deposit Account Registry Service, CDARS. Not CGARS, but CDARS. Through CDARS, Wyoming government working with a local Wyoming bank are able to obtain CDs that are issued by banks throughout the United States and therefore are eligible for full FDIC insurance. In addition, the amount of funds placed through CDARS is matched by deposits into the local bank placed on behalf of customers of other CDARS participating institutions. The net effect is that the amount of the public deposit will be available to the local bank for lending to individuals and businesses in the immediate community. So CDARS has been very popular with Wyoming government, such that more than $750 million of public funds have been placed through CDARS by governments in Wyoming. But because the provisions of the Wyoming statute, and this is the key to the bill, that enable public deposits through CDARS apply only to time certificates of deposit, the benefits of CDARS are not available for a substantial portion of public funds that are placed in money market deposit accounts and other savings accounts. The accompanying draft amendments to the statutes will have the effect of enabling political subdivisions to take advantage of a new deposit placement service known as Insured Cash Sweep, or ICS, that will make it possible for a government depositor's funds to be redeposited from an account at a local institution into interest-bearing money market deposit accounts at multiple banks throughout the country in amounts that are less than the standard FDIC insurance maximum. So you have FDIC insurance on that. Equally important, the local bank will receive matching deposits from customers of other institutions equal to the full amount of the government's funds redeposited into money market deposit accounts and at other banks through ICS. So depositors placing funds through ICS have daily access to their funds and are permitted to make up to 6 withdrawals a month. As with CDARS, the full amount of the government's deposits placed through ICS will in effect remain in the local bank and be available for lending in the community. Draw your attention, Mr. Chairman, to this handout. You know, it says smart saving, access FDI insurance on large savings deposits. There was one member of the committee thought that this was a slam dunk up there the other day. I think it is, too. I think it's a really good bill, and ask for your support.
Senator Hicks. Further discussion? All those in favor of Senator A Peterson motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 188, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 188 have passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next bill for consideration is House Bill 216. Reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill number 216, Deadly Weapons in a Courtroom. Sponsored by Representative Brown, an act relating to crimes and offenses. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Exelbel, Hicks, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report to do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 216, Deadly Weapons in a Courtroom. And to carry this good little bill, I call for the question, and here's the way we treat these. Senator, Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the bill before you clarifies the authority of the judge to really control the safety in his courtroom. It creates a crime of for those taking an unauthorized deadly weapon into the courtroom, and then provides that the judge can, the presiding judge can carry a weapon, concealed or otherwise, and determine who may carry. So, in this instance, if he felt that there are other county officials there, including the county attorney, for example, who want to have a concealed weapon, that as long as the judge so authorized that it's appropriate, frankly, it's a practice that's not uncommon, and that clarifies that for our courtrooms, we only want folks that are authorized to take the, by the judge to take weapons in the courtroom so that the judge can really know about the safety. And it's really important for those communities that don't have great outside security so that the judge can have a better feel for what's going on in his courtroom. With that explanation, if there are no questions, I'd call for the question.
Question. There is a standing committee amendment.
Oh, there was standing committee.
Please read that in.
House Bill 216, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy. Page 3, line 5.
Senator Schiffer.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll move the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 216. And, Mr. Chairman, what this does, it's more or less a cleanup. On page 3, line 5, the old words were for not less than 1 year, no more than two. We like to give judges flexibility when they're sentencing. We took out the not less than 1 year and is the words we deleted. So the sentence can be 2 years or less, and that's what we're getting at. I ask for your favorable consideration on the amendment.
You heard the motion, Senator Schiffer motion to adopt the standing committee amendment to House Bill 216. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed. We're back on the bill.
Question on the bill.
All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 216, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 216 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried. Mr. President.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 69, do pass. House Bill 65, do pass. House Bill 71, do pass. House Bill 102, do pass amended. House Bill 156, do pass amended. House Bill 172, do pass amended. House Bill 188, do pass. And House Bill 216, do pass amended. Senator Hines, Chairman.
Senator Hines.
Mr. President, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried and the report has been adopted. Messages from the House.
February the 12th, 2013, from the House of Representatives, message number 319, Committee of the Whole, indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, the House adopted the Committee of the Whole report, failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. Senate File 41, State Parks ATM Donations, ayes 27, noes 29, excused 4. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. February the 12th, 2013, from the House of Representatives, message number 320, conference passed. Mr. President, the House did concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 13, Livestock Revisions, ayes 58, excused 9. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. February the 12th, 2013, from the House of Representatives. Message number 321, conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with the Light Committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to Senate File 105. The House conferees are Representative Harshman, Chairman, Representative Eklund, and Representative Lubnow. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
February the 11th, 2013, Mr. President, Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 182, engrossed, Determination of Highway Right-of-Way on Federal Land. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Cooper, Escobel, and Landon. No, Senator Schiffer, Von Flatern. Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Signing of our old acts. Enrolled Act number, House Enrolled Act number 26, being original House Bill 21.
House Enrolled Act number 26, being original House Bill 21, an act relating to peace officers.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 26, being original House Bill 21. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 27, being original House Bill 28.
House Enrolled Act number 27, being original House Bill 28, an act relating to game and fish.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 27, being original House Bill 28. I have so signed. Enrolled Act number 28, being original House Bill 37.
House Enrolled Act number 28, being original House Bill 37, an act relating to game and fish.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 28, being original House Bill 37. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act 29, being original House Bill 53.
House Enrolled Act number 29, being original House Bill 53, an act relating to state lands.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 29, being original House Bill 53. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act 30, being original House Bill 82.
House Enrolled Act number 30, being original House Bill 82, an act relating to health insurance.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 30, being original House Bill 82. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act 31, being original House Bill 221.
House Enrolled Act number 31, being original House Bill 221, an act relating to administration of government.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act 31, being original House Bill 221. I have so signed. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Wednesday, February 13th.
Announcement, Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources, will meet in about 10 minutes, and S-15 will take up House Bill 126, Engrossed Agriculture Operations, House Bill 134, Engrossed Private Roads, House Bill 225, Engrossed Transfer of Ownership of Livestock and Brands, House Bill 228, Engrossed Transfer of Federal Land Study.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the normal committee room. House Bill 94, Engrossed Immunization by Pharmacists. House Bill 132, Engrossed Chiropractor Licensure Amendments. Both of those we've already heard and plan to finish up our work on them. And then advance notice on Friday, we'll deal with the remaining bills in the committee. House Bill 234, Home Energy Assistance Program. House Bill 224, Engrossed State Miners Hospital. And House Bill 144, Engrossed Insurance Coverage of Enzymatic Disorders. I hope to at least have testimony on that bill, and whether we finish it or carry it over to next week depends on how long things take.
Senator Hines.
Tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room 302, the hybrid energy system report will be delivered to the Joint Minerals Business and Economic Development Committee. This is open to anyone that wishes to come and listen. It will be at 8 a.m. in room 302. Also, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, will meet 15 minutes after the noon recess tomorrow, Wednesday, to take up House Bill 217, Atomic Energy Act Agreement State Study.
Senator Coe.
Mr. President, your committee number 4 meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock over here at room S-11 by the smoking lounge to take up House Bill 164, Alternative Schools, House Bill 166, Hathaway Student Scholarship Program, and House Bill 163, Engrossed Adjunct Professor Incentives.
Any further announcements? You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Senate will stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Wednesday, February 13th.